recording started. You may begin.
Thank you, staff, and welcome everyone to this meeting of the Accountability CCWG. I am Jordan Carter, for the record. Welcome to the call. I think we have a couple of council with us for the first part of the call from Sibley, and hopefully from Adler-Zoya. Stephen is here. Now, I just want to start off straight away by explaining what the agenda is. As you all know, we had a large legal document presented to us on last week, which had all of our templates with a bit of legal advice about those powers under each of them. And on Tuesday, we had a discussion, a presentation from the lawyers on our powers and mechanisms in the CCWG forum. Now, because of the reality of that meeting, while the Q&A and discussion did go on for quite a long time, first of all, there were questions, I think, that people didn't get the chance to ask or hints to raise. And secondly, it was clear in that call that the CCWG is far from agreement about the right mechanism to choose, and that's fine. And the implication of that is that there is no way for us here in Working Party 1 to come to a consensus in recommending a mechanism to the community by Friday. We just can't do it. We don't have the input. We haven't had the time to have the discussion and debate. So that's the reality we face. That's fine. And so in discussion with the co-chairs in the coordination that we have rapporteurs with co-chairs yesterday, they were relaxed about that. They said, okay, no, it isn't realistic. Don't try to do it. We clearly have to have the ongoing debate and discussion in the CCWG. And so we will. There's a CCWG call on Tuesday next week, and then there is our intensive series of meetings on Thursday and Friday next week. All of that happens before we finalize the public comment report, the first public comment report. And so the purpose of today's devoting time to these Q&A items is to give more time for this group to ask questions about the legal advice and to make suggestions to the lawyers about what they think of that advice. And what I expect is that the counsel from the firms will take those questions on board. I think that the written questions are going to be forwarded to counsel as well by the legal sub-team. And let's be really clear on what we're trying to achieve with that. It means that there will be more feedback and more consideration given to the lawyers so that when we have the full CCWG meeting coming up next week, either on the Tuesday or the Thursday-Friday intensive period, they and we are all in a better position to fine the discussion down onto the really critical points, the really critical mechanisms. So to recap, the purpose of this Q&A section, items 2 and 3 in the agenda, is to be able to ask further questions of the lawyers, make further points to the lawyers, based on the documents that you've already seen, that we already discussed in the CCWG or this call. And that is the purpose of them. So we're not trying to make decisions. We're not trying to review text. None of that is on the table for this discussion. It is us being helpful to the lawyers, us having the chance to talk about the issues, and the debate on them will be in the full CCWG with everyone next week. That's what we're trying to do. I hope that's clear. We need to keep that to 40 minutes because I want to make sure that we've got time to look at the third draft of the public comment report. And as we go through that report, I'm going to try and take notes as well as to shepherd the discussion. And after this call, I'll recirculate the document with sort of comment bubbles or chat changes that arise from the conversation, where in the end, by the end of tomorrow's call, we will hopefully have options where we disagree, or at least clear understanding where we disagree on the powers. So that is the agenda. That's what we're trying to do. The Q&As are just to help the lawyers give a chance to ask questions, and then from about 10 minutes to the top of the hour, in about 40 minutes, through to the end of the call, we will focus our work on the public comment document that was circulated about 10 or 11 hours ago. So that is the agenda. All of the documents have been circulated and linked. They are linked in the agenda. The documents are in front of us on the call. So I rely on you as participants to follow the reasonably straightforward instructions that I give about where documents are, what you need to have read, and so on. And I know that none of the material that we're looking at today is a big block of totally new content, so I hope that's okay. Now, with that explanation, Kavus, your hand is up. Please go ahead. Kavus, I don't know if you're speaking or not, but we cannot hear you.
To me? Sorry, can I talk or not?
Now we can hear you. Now we can hear you. Yes, please talk.
If I can talk, please allow me to talk. If I cannot talk, please interrupt me. Can I talk?
Please talk, yes. I hope you can hear me. Please go ahead.
I said that in every meeting that I have ever seen, for any agenda item must be associated document. So relating to the question and answer, which document related to that? Is it the enhancing ICANN accountability outside council review and recommendation, the document of 14th of April? It is that document? Which document related to that question and answer? Could you kindly identify that?
Kavus, the agenda linked directly to the document. The document was specified absolutely clearly in the agenda. For the first part of this conversation, the discussion with counsel on the mechanism, the relevant document is the one, it's the PowerPoint slide that they presented on the CCWG call on the 14th. That is what was linked on the agenda. The questions you are asking have been perfectly clear in everything that I've presented. Staff, can you please put up the PowerPoint presentation that the lawyers spoke to on the CCWG call on Tuesday? That is the subject of the first Q&A. To be very clear, the document that's on now is not the document we're discussing. If I've made a mistake, by the way, in the links that I've circulated, I humbly and totally apologize. But I'm pretty sure that what I've presented is sensible. I've also just lost access to Adobe because my entire browser has crashed.
Jordan, we're not ahead of you because we're waiting for something to be shared. The current Adobe is blank.
Okay. Josh from Sidley, you've got your hand up. Could you make a comment?
Yeah, just thank you, Jordan. This is Josh. Just a quick question. Is counsel taking questions now from the April 10 memo or from the April 14 presentation?
On the mechanism material, the most up-to-date info from the legal was the presentation given on the 14th. That's what's now on the screen. Staff, you've got the right document up. Can you please give scroll control over to the people who are participating? Thank you. So the first, we can run these two together. I'm not too worried about the thing, the order, but please, folks, queue up with questions or comments about the mechanism first, preferably. The specific powers that we're dealing with, we will go back to the long memo as linked in the agenda for that. So please, let's start a speaking list. Let's get going. Rosemary has to leave at 1:30. The sooner we get into the substance of this, the better. If there aren't questions that you want to ask on the phone, that's fine. We can move on to another agenda item. I've got a speaking list here. It doesn't just have to be questions, little insights you can offer the lawyers, but preferably at this point in the agenda, it is the mechanism stuff. So I'll take, Josh, if you can take your hand down. Robin, go ahead.
Thank you. Can you hear me? This is Robin.
We can hear you.
Great. Okay, so I have a question. As we've been discussing, one of the things that I've really been struggling to understand are the different advantages and the different disadvantages to the two models that we're looking at right now, the empowered designator model and the membership model. So I'm wondering if counsel could just give me their conclusion as to what would be the strongest reason to select each model, and what's the biggest problem that you would foresee with selecting each model. And I think that might help us in some of our evaluations going forward. Thank you.
Would you like us to respond? This is Rosemary.
Yes, I would like a reasonably free-flowing and back and forth with you guys on this. Cheryl says this is on page 16, but go ahead, whoever just spoke. I think it's Rosemary.
Yes. So I would say that the biggest, looking just at a designator model or a membership model, the biggest advantage in my mind of the membership model is also in some ways its weakness. This is not going to surprise you, which is that there is an extensive statutory framework of rights and protections of members in the corporation's code. The advantage to that is that the corporate law gives members a lot of rights with, or can easily be given rights under bylaws, if not under statute, that cannot be given to designators as easily or at all in some cases. It's absolutely prohibited in some cases. So there's a whole set of them, and some of them are important to you in terms of what you want the community to be able to do. And so that the biggest advantage of membership is that those rights are built into the corporate law and easy to give you, and we can point to a statute that says you have them, so that if we ever do have to get to an enforceability issue, it's pretty clear that the statute provides you these laws. We don't have to turn to a contract. The downside of the membership model is this extensive framework of statutory rights and protections, which will have to be built into your bylaws, or should be, because these are rights that members have, and they should, they're going to have them under law, whether you put them in your bylaws or not. We always think it's a good idea that everyone's on a level playing field, and so that we would advise putting all these kinds of protections and rights directly into the bylaws where everyone has access to them, rather than keeping them hidden in the corporation's code for only those who know to go and look. So to me, those are probably the biggest advantage is you get a lot of, it's designed to be a structure where the community has power even over the board. Whereas the weakness is because of all that, there's a lot of procedure and there's a lot of detail that would have to go into your bylaws. The biggest advantage of the designator structure is probably avoiding all of that. And the biggest disadvantage of the designator structure is that because corporate law does not give third parties that kind of right that are provided for members in the statute, then we have to look to some other way of getting at those rights to make them enforceable, which looks to contract at that point. Now, I want to make one other, what I think is a very important point, which is that, and I said this the other day, I'm not sure who was on the call where I said it, so it bears repeating in case some of you haven't heard it, which is that the California Corporations Code allows you to put in your bylaws any provision for the management of the corporation that you want internally, unless it is in one of these areas where it's just flat out prohibited by the law. So if the question is it legally viable to put in some procedure that you want the corporation to follow and the various components of the corporation to follow in terms of reconsideration or whatever it is you want, unless we tell you it is illegal in California and a nonprofit public benefit corporation to put that in, you can put it in. Then the next question is, if people refuse to follow the bylaws, what recourse would the people who want the bylaws followed have? And that's when we get to the question of enforceability. And I don't want you to think you can't have the procedure that you want or the process or the mechanism when maybe you can have it. It's just that if someone decides not to follow it within the system, you may have a more difficult time forcing it to be followed in a designator structure than in a membership structure. So that I think I tried to answer Robin's question.
Thanks, Rosemary. I think that was a good explanation. All to get these questions and answers flowing, I'm not proposing that we will debate all the answers, but we will have a chance to debate these topics on the full CCWG. Just a reminder, this is Q&A. We'll carry on with the speaking list. Avery, you're next. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Avery speaking. My question has to do with something that I've never understood, and it's the whole litigious processes that we go through in this country. Now, and I'm not sure I even understood correctly. As if the SOs and ACs become associations, I understood that there was some kind of liability to suit associated with that. I didn't quite understand to what degree that was, so I wanted to give an example to see if that fell within and without, and forgive me for the stupidity of my example. But let's say the GNSO designed a GTLD policy that everybody hated and that various people believed was responsible for them losing millions of dollars. Could they be sued for this? The second part of the question is, do both of the models require creating these associations, or can the designator model work with just what we've got now, or would there also need to be this formalization? Thank you.
May I answer that second question first, and then I think I would defer maybe to Holly's team on the suing, although we could give you our views of it.
Go ahead.
So I'm sorry, now I've forgotten the question.
Unincorporated association.
Yeah, do you need unincorporated association?
Is it required under members and designators?
So the California corporate law requires that members be legal persons. So for the membership model, we need legal persons. That's a full stop. For the designator model, it is our strong advice that you have the designators be legal persons. We would not advise creating a structure with designators that were not legal persons, simply because then you have no legal entity that could ever enforce anything under the bylaws or under a related contract. So right now, you have bylaws that have designators that that are not legal persons. Let me point out that that's worked for you for a really long time. So maybe you don't care about the enforceability that you get with having legal persons, especially because having legal persons will bring with it other issues and complications. But we think that those issues and complications are outweighed, as we understand your needs anyway, by the benefits of having unincorporated associations, be the members or the designators.
Question in the chat about what is the risk if they are not legal persons.
So the risks of not having legal persons, first of all, in the membership model, you simply can't do it. The law says members are persons. So you'd be throwing out the membership model. You'd look at the designator model. The risk of having them not be legal persons is simply they can't act as outside the – they only exist as internal units of organization inside ICANN. They have no other existence, and therefore, if somehow the bylaws were amended to eliminate a designator, for example – right now, with the way the bylaws are now, the group eliminated would have no recourse. Or any other group that felt that the elimination had been done in a bad way. Because there's no person there with any legal rights. So that's the risk, I think, was the question.
Mm-hmm.
The other downside of unincorporated associations is you are creating people. You're creating legal persons. And that means what we want out of that is that they have the right to contract and they have the right to sue, but they will also have the burden of being sued. They could be sued. As we currently envision it, these unincorporated associations would have no assets, and therefore they're not so much a target for suit because you can't get blood from a turnip, as we say. There's no money there. But they could be sued. But what would be sued is the unincorporated association itself and not the individuals participating in it. In California, there is what you call a corporate shield in the corporate form exists also in the unincorporated association form, that the individual warm-blooded people who participate in an unincorporated association are not liable by virtue of being its participants for its debts or its liabilities or its contracts, for example. I don't know, does Sidley want to speak to the issue of suing, which I think was the other question Avery asked.
Yeah, this is Holly Gregory. I'm sitting here with Sharon Flanagan, and that's why you're not seeing me on the chat with the hand up. So if I recall, I mean, I agree absolutely with what Rosemary has said. The issue I would like to understand more is the great concern that we hear about lawsuits. We think that forming as unincorporated associations should not pose great legal liability here at all. And there are devices that we can use to, you know, protect. We can have indemnification and, provisions that ICANN will hold all the persons harmful. But as Rosemary said, these incorporated associations, unincorporated associations don't have legal assets, so there's very little to go after them, and the individual people who serve on them should not have legal liability. That being said, you know, crazy people can bring crazy lawsuits, so the risk of getting sued isn't really the risk that you want to focus on. It's the risk that in getting sued, you would somehow be held to liability. I mean, suits get filed all the time that have to get dismissed because they don't have, the basic requisites to stand. So, yes, crazy people might file lawsuits, but we think that they would get thrown out pretty quickly. So does that answer the question? I hope that I got it all.
I think it does. Avery, are you happy for us to move on?
If I may, we don't think that this is a significant concern.
Happy to move.
Okay. Thank you. My Adobe room has just temporarily vanished. I can't quite recall who's next on the speaker list. I think it might be Steve Del Bianco. But could the person whose next hand is up please go?
Thanks, Jordan. It's Steve Del Bianco with the Commercial Stakeholders Group, or CSG, which is part of the GNSO. Question for the attorneys has to do with implications between members and designators about one particular peculiarity that we may have within ICANN. It turns out that one of the ACSOs, the GNSO, Generic Name Supporting Organization, has within it four incredibly distinct stakeholder groups. You talked about warm-blooded individuals. Well, we're full-throated and sometimes even hot-blooded. And for that reason, the GNSO would have great difficulty, if not impossibility, of coalescing into a single vote on many issues. And again, voting is not perfect. It ends up being the way in which we figure out if the members or delegates have a super to reject a budget, to reject a bylaws change, to invoke an IRP, and all the subsequent. So in that vein, we discussed the idea of the GNSO, since it has four stakeholders group, needs a way to have four distinct votes, even if they're weighted in such a way that the GNSO is no more or less voice than the other ACs and SOs. So it might just be a math problem, but I'm hoping it's also not a legal problem. That's why I'm asking you now if there are any impediments or designators, impediments to having a formulaic voting so that there could be four entities within GNSO who cast a quarter of the vote each. And in the opposite way is the weight that the other ACSOs have four votes so that the voting people, but the voices are distinct. So I'll stop. I don't know whether you've even heard of this issue before, but it's paramount in the eyes of those of us in the GNSO. Thank you.
Can I speak to that?
Go ahead.
In a membership structure, members of different classes could be given different votes. You could allow, if you choose to allow a member, if for some reason the member only has one vote, if you wanted to allow them to vote it in quarters, you could do that. If it made sense to increase the total number of votes so that member class got four votes, you could do that. And on the designator structure, again, we're not contemplating the designators would each appoint their own directors as the SOs and ACs, and I know that's not exactly perfectly mapped, but under the existing structure that you have, certain internal organizational units appoint directors. It's those internal organizational units with the same number of directors that they currently appoint that we would envision being either the designators appointing those same number of directors each, or the members, each a class of member appointing the same number of or electing, however that member wants to do it internally, that same number of members, same number of directors, sorry.
So this is Holly Gregory. I agree that Rosemary has given you one pathway. Another pathway is how you're making decisions now about how to put a director on, how to designate a director in your GNSO group. You could do all of the voting in that same mechanism. So, for example, you could take a vote within your group and the majority vote that wins within your group is how you vote on as a designator or as a member. So there are a variety of pathways, all of which offer a solution.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that question. Look, we've still got a few people on the speaking list. I'd also invite you, if you want to ask questions about the Powers memo, the April 10 memo with the 60-odd pages or 80-odd pages. Feel welcome to that as well. We've got about 20 minutes of the session to run, 25 minutes maybe. Olivier, you are the next speaker. Please go ahead. Olivier Lurent, we at the moment can't hear you, so if you are muting, please go ahead. Okay, Olivier is having some audio trouble evidently. Jonathan, could you please go ahead with your question while we work out what the issue is with Olivier?
I sure can, thank you. I guess I wanted to rephrase or get some clarification on a question I asked the legal folks on a previous call, which is about designing a mechanism to induce the board to, and maybe, Stephanie, you may have referred to it as induce the board to consider or something like that, and what such a mechanism might look like and what we would need to build in to create that power, because most of what we're building right now is the ability to review a board decision, but if the but if there's no decision, then none of those things come into play. So it's about looking at advice from FSAC or ATRT, et cetera, and inducing the board to make a determination that would then be subject to review, if that makes sense.
Thanks, Jonathan. Are there councillors who would respond to that?
This is Holly. I'm sorry,
Jonathan. Were you still asking your question because we lost your audio for a bit?
I didn't hear what you said. No, go ahead. Please go ahead and answer. Thank you.
So I understand the question to be what kinds of mechanisms could be used to force a reconsideration by the board. I think either in...
Well, not a reconsideration, a consideration.
Okay, a consideration by the board. Fine. I think in either the member structure or a designator structure, we could develop a process that provides whenever either the designators or the members petition the board for a hearing, they get a hearing. Now we can do that by a supermajority vote or a regular vote, but we can simply have a mechanism that says if the group formally asks the board for a meeting to consider an issue, they shall have such a meeting. In other words, you give a convening power to the group, to the community, to call a session that's jointly held with the board. And we think that should be pretty straightforward.
As a way to initiate something. Okay, and you think that there, I guess the question is, if we get that hearing from the board, would that mechanism include the board needing to pass a resolution or make a decision that would then be subject to the review mechanisms that we're already working on, the IRP and things like that? In other words, can we through the process you're describing, petition not just for a meeting with the board or hearing from the board, but a decision by the board, one way or the other, not a particular decision, but a decision that would then subject the board to review?
But
that makes sense?
And in the review of the board, then, meaning a potential to recall the board or to get rid of some of the directors?
No. I mean, that's a big one. But yeah, I just mean the other things that we're developing, like the independent review process, that are sort of softer accountability measures than board removal and things, they need to be triggered by they all involve reconsideration of a decision made by the board. So part of this process would need to be to generate a decision that would then be subject to review.
Certainly. Okay. So I don't see why the decision of the board, the meeting of the board. Look, at the meeting that you call, there are three potential decisions. do the thing that folks want, not do the thing, or not take a decision. And you could have the not take a decision be a trigger as well.
For an IRP, for example.
I don't see why not. I mean, you get to define what the triggers for an IRP are going to be. So one trigger could be, we have formally requested action and the board has not taken action. And therefore, because we've made the formal request and the board has not granted our request and taken the action, we trigger a review. Now, the question is, what are you reviewing? At that point, you're kind of stuck reviewing a process. But I think
I'm going to call time on this one, folks. I think the issue is raised and needs to be further teased out. But the point of this session is to get the questions on the table. So with your permission, Jonathan and Councillor, can we move on to the next?
Yes.
And there's no distinction between the two mechanisms as far as the ability to do this. One wouldn't make it easier or harder. I guess that's the only other
I think in
question.
All cases it's easier with the membership, but I think this is something we could probably work around in the designator. You know, the devil's always in the details, and we haven't tried to put pen to paper to make it happen. But as I sit here, I'm not aware of a reason why we couldn't come up with something creative.
Okay, thanks. And sorry, Jordan, for hogging the microphone.
No, that's all right. We're making good progress, and I think this is airing lots of questions that are useful and put to the council. Jonathan, thank you. Hand down. Olivier Laurent, can you please try again? Can we hear you this time? Is the audio working?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. Thank you. Yes, I have a question about the nominating committee following the conversation we had about it during the last meeting with the whole group. I understand that the nominating committee will have to be a legal entity, a member, let's say. And I also understand that the removal of board members that have been nominated by the nominating committee could only be done by the nominating committee member itself. Did I understand it right?
Holly, are you able to respond to that?
Josh, are you on the phone?
I am, but I couldn't hear the question very well.
I had difficulty as well. Would it be possible for someone to restate the question, please?
Thank you.
Olivier, can you restate the question for us?
Sure. At the meeting, you discussed about the nominating committee. You said that the nominating committee had to be a legal entity, a member also. And the question is, how do we do the removal of a single board member that has been nominated by the nominating committee? I understand it can only be done by the nominating committee. Did I understand it right from last meeting?
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Did you understand?
Thank you. That is correct. Under the designator system, the only one who can remove a director that's been designated by an entity is that entity. And that is why if you go with a designator system, we would need to think about how to take the nominating committee and make it into a more formal entity such that it could be a designator officially.
But with the member system, there is no problem.
Well, the point, Olivier, I think even if you went with a member system, it doesn't mean that you can't have a mix, if you will, of members and designators. So you could still have the nominating committee be organized and be a designator. So it's not, doesn't have voting rights in the same way that members do, because it really just exists to nominate certain directors. And withdraw those directors if the nominating committee is not pleased with them. So I think that was the point that was being made before, that even with a member-organized ICANN, you could still organize the nominating committee as a designator.
Okay, thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks, Olivier. Jonathan, this is an old hand, I assume. We've had a little change in the order in the room, but Kavutz was next for Greg. So, Kavutz, could you please ask your question?
My question is the following. On page 3 of the legal assessment of 10th of April, it is mentioned that in the designator model, if we add additional measures such as contractual arrangement or board within the board, we could resolve the issue of legal entity. Is that right? My question is that with all advantages of the membership, it is very complex, time-consuming, radical changes, and a lot of details which may take months, if not years. Would it be possible that we take the designator and add some additional measures in order to reply or respond to all, if possible, if not to major requirement that we have? The major requirement is removal of one board member, removal of entire board member, change of the bylaw, and the two issues that you told on the 14th of April that we cannot do with a designation is budget and a strategic plan. This you told we cannot do. Whether today you add the change of bylaw to that, I don't know. But what we can do with the most workable method, which does not require major changes, taking existing structure, adding new measures in order to satisfy almost all of our requirements. Is it possible or not? This is first question. Second question, if we do not add any additional measure with designator, which of the five actions that we have asked, removal of one board, removal of entire board, change of the bylaw, budget, and a strategic plan, which one we cannot do and which one we can do? This is a simple question, and I would appreciate if the answer should be given. Thank you.
Thanks, Kavutz. Council, do you have some responses to those two questions?
Certainly. So this is Holly Gregory. Under the designator system, the problem is that designators cannot be given the ability to veto or approve certain board decisions around budget and strategy and certain other things that may come up. For example, if you wanted to have the ability to veto or approve certain decisions by a review process. Everything else we believe can be done, the appointing and removing directors through a use of contractual means added in, the ability to recall the entire board, as well as the ability to approve and amend the bylaws and reject efforts by the board to do so.
Thanks, Holly. Is that both questions responded to?
I think it was both questions.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
One thing to add to the question or the answer with, you know, what is the minimal amount of work that would be required. I want to remind you, Kasuf, to take you back to what Rosemary said in the beginning, which is advice that Sidley agrees with, too, that that even if you decided to maintain just a designator structure, both firms strongly advise that you all organize your designators, if they aren't already unincorporated associations, that you organize them into unincorporated associations or some other legal entity so that they can get the protections against liability. Those entities can become a shield to protect the individuals against liability. And those entities could, if there were a need to in the future because the board ignored the designator rights, those entities would have standing to, because they would be recognized entities, they would have standing to enforce their rights. So to be clear, there's work to be done even if the designator model is the model that's retained.
Thanks, Josh. Good addressing the questions. Greg, you're next on the speaking list.
Thank you, Jordan. Greg Shatton, for the record. Not sure. I guess one, there was this kind of a second part or second aspect to Cavus's question, which was, or maybe it was an assumption, that putting the membership into place would be a much more involved and complex and lengthy process than putting the designator structure properly into place. Rather than giving my own opinion as a lawyer but not counsel, I'd like to ask yours. Thanks.
This is Michael Clark, if I could respond, because I think I did that slide. I don't think that that it actually would be considerably more complex than a designator structure at all. I think the way that you currently are organized involves groups that behave in many ways like members. And I fully agree with what Josh said, that, you know, there'll be some work to do either way. And I think, you know, the one advantage in particular of the member structure is that it relies on much more familiar and somewhat settled areas of law, and I really don't see it as being much more complicated to implement or a really radical change from the other option, the designator structure.
Okay. Thanks.
This is Adler Colvin chiming in on that, on the member versus designator structure. And just to add the other, this is Ingrid Mittermeier with Adler Colvin. I think on some level, you can look at any discrete member right and say it doesn't add a huge level of complexity. I do think it's important to appreciate that in California, there is this very important statutory sort of elaborate member structure that it does include all these sort of protections, you know, notice requirements, record inspection rights. So there is a sort of fairly elaborate set of member rights that I do think make it, you know, more complicated to implement. I think it's probably not quite right to say that it's the same level of complexity as designator. With designator, you have more flexibility, but because of sort of the statutory framework for members, you are dealing with all those various requirements, which has its pluses and minuses, but it is something that needs to get worked through.
Yeah, thank you. And look, people, I certainly, if I was one of the lawyers, I would be quite grateful for this discussion, because it's teased out a number of more issues. It's kind of alluded to another set of issues that need to be looked at in more detail. And it's helping to convey to the legal teams the nuances, the flavors of the ICANN community. The only thing I would like to add at this point, aside from thanking you, counsel, from Heather and from Sidley, for your participation and answers, is that the ICANN community, I think, is pretty proud of the model that it's built. And a lot of it does look a bit novel from the legal point of view at first glance. I know that you're pretty new to this engagement, so I just want to say that as we go through the work of the next few weeks and months, a lot more of this nuance will be coming out. Some of these debates have been had and resolved, for instance, the comment that Cheryl just made. So I think we're making good progress. I'm just acknowledging the fact that we are, you know, at the start of an ongoing process. So thank you again for your participation in this call so far. And I'm going to move us on to our next agenda item, if I could. And Councillor, welcome to leave or stay as they see fit. Oh, hang on. Before we do that, I have a question, which I'm hoping that Greg can answer. Greg, as a member of the legal subteam, we invited people to raise questions in writing on the email list about these documents to also help inform Council. The people who couldn't be at this call or couldn't be on the calls or wanted to register them. Can you give us a 1 or 2 minute snapshot about what happens with those questions, assuming they aren't going into a black hole and being ignored. Is it okay for people just to put them on the list? Do they need to take other steps? Are they filtering through to the council?
Thank you, Jordan. It's Greg Chatton. Yes, these questions are getting through to council. They are not going to a black hole. They are reviewed by the legal sub-team, so not every question necessarily goes to council. There are some questions that are just either not germane or already answered, and we do want to keep our council alive and not exhaust them completely. But by and large, the questions do go through. They are taken off the list and either sent through or, in the most recent instance, Leon collated several of the questions into a single document, or they were collated for Leon. And we had our legal sub-team meeting earlier today, and we went through several of those collated questions. You know, with regard to whether they required, we went through them first by ourselves and then with counsel. And, you know, not in every case will they result in kind of a formal complete response, because, again, it may determine that they've, you know, been answered or that they're off topic. But by and large, you know, we'd be looking to kind of work those through and get responses back. And in some cases, those responses may end up in larger documents. You know, it's up to counsel in each case and us to try to find the best and most efficient way to answer those questions. They are, of course, very helpful. And using the general email list is just fine, as long as they're clearly labeled as a question for counsel. And depending upon what email system you use, if you're answering if you're in a long thread where you've decided to, on email number 17, to call out a question for counsel, that might get buried. So it's better to break it out and turn it into a new email with a was in the subject, as well as a question for legal counsel in the subject. That's just a, you know, logistical suggestion. You know, each of us in the legal sub-team, I think, are, you know, greater or lesser extent, as well as staff, keeping an eye on the list and looking for anything that says, you know, referral or question for legal counsel. Just, you know, keep those cards and letters coming. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, so hopefully that's clear with people. My point is not that everyone is going to expect individual responses. It's just that it kind of adds to the Q&A, and as long as counsel are getting them, to have the context, to have the picture that's being raised, I think that's helpful as it feeds through into other documents. Thank you. I would like to turn our attention now to agenda item number 4, which is the next draft of our public comment document. If the staff could put version 3 of that document, not track changes, but just the plain text of the document. As we did last time, we had this kind of conversation in the document, the meeting. We have a chance to look through each section and to just see the new content. I've tried to pick out new content or drafting notes to you in yellow highlights italicized. And the remaining areas where there's uncertainty are, or disagreement, are as they used to be in black, bold, underlined, and I think they're also italicized. I've been trying, for the record, to distinguish things in ways that people who are colorblind will be able to understand. And to remind, we've got about 50 minutes left, 55 minutes or so on this call to work through this. I will be trying to take some track changes notes in the documents as we go. I'm assuming that we won't finish our work through of this content today, but I will circulate after the call the version of it that I take notes on. We will pick it up again tomorrow and make any final decisions on the content in this public comment document. content, and then after that it will go into the pre-use. It'll be collated along with all of the other inputs across the CCWG into the first draft of our public comment report, which we will then have our couple of days next week to read, reflect on, and think. So that's the track that we're on at the moment. The document is in front of you, and I'll kind of lead you through it, and we'll take questions whenever they come up. I'll ask for input on each section as we go through. The first thing, though, is to take any questions about what I've just stepped you through, and I see that Caruso's hand is up. Caruso, please go ahead.
Yes, Jordan, is it possible that if you want to review this document, you take it at least paragraph by paragraph, allowing us to concentrate on a particular issue but not going from one side of the document to the other side? Is it possible that you can do that? Because I have some question. I organize it in that manner and mark it up, and I wish to raise it if you allow. Thank you.
Yep. Caruso, yes, that's, I thought, what I just explained that we are going to do. We are going to do it part by part. So we'll start that process now.
Comment 652?
No, because we're not up to that yet. We'll do it, as you said, in order. And so the first thing to draw your attention to, ladies and gentlemen, is in the first part of the document. If you've got scroll control of this version, in 6.5.1, we had some holding text. We had nothing written about the mechanism that we might choose to employ. And there was, of course, a good reason for that, which was that we didn't know what our mechanism was going to be. We still don't, but in discussion with the co-chairs, please also, yes, everyone should have their own scroll control on this. I prepared some initial text to just be a holding text for this part of the report. I don't know if it'll make it through, but it's trying to represent the fact that we haven't made decisions on the mechanism, that we can't do so yet. But we might need to say something in our document. So you can see that, I think, pretty clearly right in front of you at the moment. The specifics, it says, will come in the second public comment report. I've emphasized the point that we want to be conservative and minimalist in the structural organizing changes that we would do to allow the powers to be exercised. That we're not trying to invent an entirely new way of representing the community, so we're not going for one number, one vote. We're not going to create some weird collection of SOs. We're not going to say that the GNSO isn't allowed to have its support groups. And the third bullet point reflects where we got to in Istanbul, that an equality voting and the supporting organization. Now, I'm just going to add it in my version. There's a suggestion from Robin on the email list today that instead of that, equality of votes between or representation or influence between the three supporting organizations, that it should be based on the same proportions of influence as exists in the ICANN board. So I'm just flagging that at the moment. I would ask for a speaking list on this part, 6.5.1, about this content. Are there any who would like to speak to this part? Caruso, I still see your hand is up. I don't know if you've got a comment on this part or not. If you do have a comment on this part, please go ahead.
Yeah, 6.5.2. Yes, I have raised...
6.5.1, Caruso, we're talking about 6.5.1, not 6.5.2.
Okay. No comment. Sorry.
Okay, please take your hand down.
I lower my hand. I'm sorry. I lower my hand.
Yep. That's okay. No problem. Are there any comments that people would like to make on this one? Okay. I've written in the version that I'll send around after this, which has comments that arise from this call. I've got an alternative proposal from Robin Gross, the decisional influence balance should be the same as the representation on the ICANN board. So I think that that tables that for further discussion. And if there isn't, if there's anything more to discuss on this, then we will move on to 6.5.2. And I see no hands up. So the next one is 6.5.2, the power to project budget or strategy operating plans. Now, we had quite a long discussion about this last time, and the discussion was about what do we mean? Are we asking for essentially the right to petition the boards and to send back the budget for another look, and then would the boards be required to have a higher threshold to pass it the next time? Or are we looking for these rights to do that more than once? So I've tried to clarify the language. This is on page 2 and page 3 of the document. To just clarify that, it's just an evolution of the language. We didn't come to a consensus about removing the bold underline. I just realized I haven't been consistent with my formatting, but the bold underlines are still what isn't agreed. We haven't necessarily got consensus that you have to raise all the issues in the first cut. I don't remember the people who opposed that. And the voting strength for sending it back and whatever mechanism we've got. So I'll take speaking this. Robin, I'll take Caboose first on this because he did have his hand up before on it. So Caboose, please go ahead.
Yes, this is a point that I have raised several times, but unfortunately it was not taken. If you look into the page 3 of this issue under the 6.5.2, in paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, you are talking of adjustment and passing amendment. If you take that term, it means that the first issue is not rejection, it's reconsideration, and then followed by rejection if no action is taken. Therefore, the title at least should be reconsideration and or rejections and so on and so forth. You do not start immediately with rejections. It doesn't seem logical that without giving any opportunity to the board, you just reject. You should first give them the opportunity to reconsider, make amendment, and so on and so forth, and then send it. If after one or two, whatever time you decide, there is no action, then you reject that. And you need the measurements or measures, not measurements, the measures to how to reject that by voting and the threshold and so on and so forth. So I suggest that the title here should be reconsideration, oblique stroke, rejection, and then in the document we start with reconsideration first and asking them to amend or make some changes, and then if still the community is not satisfied, then we reject that. This is the question I raised several times, and throughout this document you have these inconsistencies in the text with the title with respect to the rejection of budget strategy and operating plan. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. I now understand what I meant by a note I couldn't remember the meaning of, which was the specificity. I think in all cases, in dealing with the budget or a strategic plan, in all cases, what we are honestly talking about is the reconsideration requirement that comes with a block on execution while reconsideration is going on. Because in each case, if the community organized through whatever way is going to send back the budget, it has to explain what its concerns are. And hopefully we are agreed that it can't just table new ones each time. It has to raise a set of concerns, probably ones that have been ventilated during the budget or strategic planning process, and say to the board, essentially, look, you can't go ahead with this because you haven't taken the feedback into account. And then the board would reconsider that matter and would propose a revised budget or plan back to the community. Then what happens? If it still isn't fixed, we don't have one reconsideration and veto, because in the end, the corporation does have to have a budget or a strategic plan and so on. That's what the companies do. And no one, I think, wants to have anyone other than the board signing it off. If the community isn't happy, it does the same thing. It blocks it again and sends it back. Now, I agree we need to get the titles right. Caboose, I've heard your title suggestion, which is reconsideration / rejection. So I've put that in a comment note on the thing, and we will end up with something that's consistent once we've finally got agreement around the PCWG about exactly what it is that we're proposing.
Second question on the same paragraph, if you allow me.
Okay, quick follow-up.
Second comment is on page 3, paragraph 2, starting the third line, generally based on perceived inconsistencies with the purpose, mission, and role of the ICANN as stated in bylaw and article. That is quite clear, we can do that. But when we come to the global public interest, what are the criteria that the community could say that the global interest, public interest has not been met? What are the criteria for that? What is the criteria of needs of the ICANN stakeholders? Do we have already specified what are the ICANN stakeholders? Then we could say that, this number 2 or 3 or X of this defined or predetermined ICANN stakeholder has not been met. So this is very subjective and is difficult. And the last one is financial stability and other matters of concerns of the community. Financial stability may be possible, but the two I have mentioned, global public interest and needs of ICANN stakeholders, is difficult to judge, and it is too subjective, and there is no criteria unless we predetermine or define them somewhere that these are the public interests, which we had failed to define that in the previous meeting of the CCWG, and we leave it as it was, saying that don't discuss the public interest, and with respect to ICANN, needs of ICANN stakeholders, I don't know. Who could define that? What is the ICANN stakeholders?
Thanks,
we could say that is met or is not met. How we could justify that?
Thanks, Kabir. You might remember that in earlier drafts, we didn't give any, because the consensus arising out of the Istanbul meeting was that this power should not be constrained by objective criteria, that in the end it was a political decision for the community to decide whether it couldn't deal with things proposed in a budget or a strategic plan. So that is why the text looks like the criteria is subjective. They are entirely subjective. They are designed to give a flavor of the sorts of reasons why the community might choose to go back and say, please look at this budget again. And that's because of that's a deliberate design decision. So what I've seen down as a comment and question, noting it's from you, is should we be more objective with these criteria? And I think that's a good question to ask, a good one for us to debate, and we should have that noted. So I've got that noted. But it isn't accidental. It isn't an omission. It's deliberate. My Adobe room has crashed yet again, so I can't see who's next on the speaking list. But from memory, it is Robin. Robin, could you please go ahead?
Thank you. This is Robin. Can you hear me?
I can.
Great. Okay, so I just had a couple comments on this section, and one is just a little bit of a wording quibble, I think. We want to change on page 3, the second full paragraph that Cavus was just referring to, it says, this new power would give the community the ability to consider strategic and operating plans and budgets after they are adopted by the board, but before they come into effect, et cetera. I think we want to change the word adopted there to approved. And I noticed the same language is several places in the document, so I think we want to make that change in the other places as well, because I think we can say it's not quite adopted yet until it's gone through this process where the community hasn't called for a reconsideration of it. So I think it's just more exact if we say approved, so as to not give the impression that it has come into effect, which is sort of the opposite of what we just say after that. So that's just one
minor
rule. Makes
perfect sense, Robin. Thanks.
Okay, and the other point is the ratio or the percentage that we've ascribed here, 50% to would be required to reject the first time, 60% for subsequent rejections. I'm thinking these would be higher. I think it would be pretty easy to whip up 50% of the community to vote against just about anything. So I think these are somewhat extreme measures that we're taking or that we're trying to create. And so I would suggest we raise these by 10-15% or so.
Can I ask you a follow-up question, Robin?
Yes.
Which is, we at some point will need to look at a relativity between all these powers, the relativity of the difficulty in raising them. And I think in discussion we've said that this should be easier to do than things like removing ICANN directors. So my practical question is, are you happy if I note with a comment bubble that Robin suggests these should be higher thresholds, perhaps 10-15% higher in each case?
Okay.
And then we'll go from there. Is that okay at this point?
Yeah, because I just think that, you know, if we make it too low, that we're just going to have to do, it's just going to be a regular course of every year we're going to have to deal with the budget rejection process. And
yeah.
I don't think
that's we want to get there.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. We're not trying to create that at all. And I think it's worth noting as well for Workstream 2, I think some concrete improvements to the planning process will be on the agenda. It becomes even less likely that this never has to be exercised. So I've noted those that comment there. Are there any other sort of speakers in respect of the 6.5.2? Thanks, Robin. If you could pull your hand down, that'd be great. Cavus, I see your hand up again. Please go ahead.
Yes, sorry. You will excuse me raising hand again. I agree with Robin that this threshold is low. I mark it up here, and I don't know where this 60% comes from. Usually we have 50 plus 1, 66%, 2/3, 75%, 3/4, and 80%, 4/5. So I suggest that we raise this first one to 67% or 66% and 75% to give some sort of stability, but not so quickly changing the situation because of the work involved. So I support the idea launched by Robin. Thank you.
Thanks, Cavus. I've noted that as well. Greg, I see your hand up.
Thank you, Jordan. Greg Shatton. I would add myself to the list of those who think the threshold should be higher to reject or override the board on budget or on strategic plan. I think that in terms of the way this is phrased, I think maybe this will change once we identify a mechanism or structure. The way I think about the right of a member of the members of an organization to deal with the budget is more in terms of approval than rejection, but that I think is maybe typical, but not required. So I don't know if there should be considered to be an approval process post board by the members, or is this invoked, and it's not clear whether this would be invoked every time a board passed a budget or a strategic plan, that it would make a stop at the members, or would it only be that, would it merely be that the members would have the right in, during a particular period of time to raise an issue with the budget, or it would be then finally considered approved. So maybe these are more mechanical questions than they are fundamental questions. But as I look at this, I kind of start worrying about those things, and maybe that's a level of detail we're not going to get to in this draft. But in any case, those are my thoughts. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. That's helpful. Someone came into my reading room and interrupted me in the middle of your comment, which I apologize for. Does your comment that what we've talked about in the text is that there would be room in the process for it to happen before the final approval? At some point, the board does do final approvals of these documents. Is there a particular thing you want me to note for the next for the CCWG to consider here?
Well, I think, one question is whether this is a positive right to approve or a negative right to reject, and whether that would, I don't know if that makes a difference, and maybe if council wants to weigh in on that, I'd be interested to hear it, or this may just be a detour, for which I apologize.
This is not a positive right of approval. This definitely isn't seeking to make a co-decision process for the budget between the ICANN board and whatever the community ends up with as a mechanism. That isn't happening.
I see Robin saying in the chat. But,
I'm sorry, Robin, that interpretation just isn't right. This is saying that after a document has been approved, whatever the language change we just agreed to by the board, there's a process, a time in the process where the community can stop it and send it back. If it was an approval process, a positive affirmation of agreement would be required. Nobody has proposed that.
Thinking the opposite of the meaning of a positive right to approve. So I appreciate you going through what you mean by positive right to approve.
So we're not saying, hey, ICANN board, you need us to come and take this. We're saying, hey, if there's a fundamental problem and enough of us think that we get to this threshold, you're going to have to reconsider it. Here's the problem. And if we don't like the way that you've reconsidered it, with ourselves imposing ourselves yet a higher threshold to do it again, we can send it back to you again. So that's what we're talking about.
Okay, that's right.
And that's important because we have to leave the board generally in control of these things for the reason that if we're going to hold them generally to account for these things, they've got to be making decisions on them. That's why these powers are framed as send back, reconsider, not you have to change this to say this, and we are going to approve it or not. Look, I'm going to move on, if I may, to the 6.5.3. And I will just say that in the next version of this, I think it will be helpful if I just put little numbers on each of the paragraphs. I won't be able to make them like 6.5.3.1, et cetera, but I will try to just make it easier to follow by adding numbers. So 6.5.3 is the power to reject changes to the ICANN bylaws. The changes I've made for this, if you're reading the track changes version, you'll see it, are just aimed at mainly making it a little bit clearer that nothing fundamental has changed. Aside from in the last version, we increased the threshold that would be required to reject and I would ask for a speaking list on this one, rejecting changes to the ICANN bylaws. Noting the same points already, let's consider it as on board the fact that the title does need to more clearly match the content. Title to match content as noted with 6.5.2. So speaking with Summit's one, Caboose, I see your hand up.
Yes, the same comment as 6.5.2. The title should be consistent with the text. In the text, we are talking of reconsideration. In the title, we're just talking of rejection. So perhaps we should introduce the same thing, reconsideration and rejection if when required and so on and so forth. This is the first thing. I have a general comment. Maybe you have dealt with, I was not with you. How you distinguish between the bylaw and fundamental bylaw? Are there something is marked up in the bylaws that these items are fundamental and the other items are non-fundamental, because you have different approaches for that and different thresholds. So is it possible that if I missed this discussion, if possible, if it doesn't take your time, you clarify how you could distinguish between the bylaw changes and changes to the fundamental bylaw? Which are the bylaws which are fundamental? So this is general question, and particular question is about the timelines that you have mentioned and about the threshold. Still, I have problem with the timeline. If 2 weeks is too short, in third paragraph, in particular when coincident with some holidays and so on and so forth, and the community could not react in 2 weeks. And the third one is the threshold. I think the threshold is low, and I don't know where the 70% comes. As I mentioned, we have 3/4 or 4/5. 3/4 is 75% and 4/5 is 80%. And I suggest we increase the threshold, but not making so too low. So these are the questions that I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Good questions all. On the general point about the title matching, already accepted. Yep, noted that. On the point about the time frame, it's important to remember that with the bylaws process, a bylaws change that works its way through the ICANN system, there is already extensive public comment required, and I think it's a 40-day period for public comments on the bylaw text. So in this process, in this final last gasp, last reserve, no, you can't go ahead with that power, we do not need to provide the same amount of time that has already been presented. I'm very certain that if the community is moving towards rejecting a proposed change to the bylaws, it will have been subject of debate very early on in its process, possibly even before the board even decides to propose a bylaw change. And that would be before there's a public comment. So literally months and months of public debate, consideration, discussion would already have happened before we got anywhere near this process. That is why I think the 2-week window is reasonable. That said, I have noted a comment and a question from you, Caboose, for the next version of this that does raise exactly that question. The third point that I had down raising was the higher thresholds. I really, honest, just as a personal comment, I wish you wouldn't keep saying, I don't know where these come from. I could say the same back to you. I don't know where your ratios come from. These numbers come from the suggestions that people have made. There's no problem suggesting they'd be higher. I've noted from you a suggestion that 3/4 or 4/5 threshold would be preferable. That's noted in the comment period. So thank you. I don't think I've missed any of the points that you raised there. You'll see your comments reflected. Are there any other speakers on this bylaw rejection power? And if not, then we can move along to 6.5.4. Avery, your hand is up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question. It was one of Bruce's questions. He had asked, how do we distinguish between the things that are fundamental bylaws and the things that aren't? I actually wondered about that myself. Are they in a special section? Do they have a big star beside them? How do we know which is which?
I apologize for missing that question, because thank you, Aubrey, for bringing it back. That is my understanding is that we would be proposing what the fundamental bylaws are, and that is coming from Working Party 2. It's mainly centered around the core mission and values and that kind of community charter that was discussed earlier. So Working Party 2 is going to propose what should be so-called fundamentals, and they will be identified in the bylaws. And what makes them fundamental is a different process to amend them compared to the current process. It's a process that is A, takes longer, and B, does require a positive co-decision process between the board and the community under the proposal that we've got next, which is our proposal for approving the bylaws. So that's a very important point to have raised. I apologize for missing it before. They will be visible. It will be clear what the fundamental bylaws are. We will be making recommendations to the community through Working Party 2 work about what they are and the rationale for making them more entrenched. Our part of this process is just noting the different process that would be required to approve changes to them, which will also be reflected in more detail in the Working Party 2 comment report content. All of that said, it is worth noting, and I'll just add a comment in the start, saying where are these represented and which bylaws are fundamental, noting that it's a Working Party 2 issue. Are they listed? Which ones are fundamental? WP2. So thank you for that. Greg, I see your hand is up, and then Kazus. So Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks. Greg Chatton again. Just to add that, and somewhat putting my lawyer hat on, that fundamental bylaws tend to be those that go to the essence or fundamental nature of the corporation, which is the other reason they're called fundamental bylaws. And it does sound like the ones that are being proposed, you know, are fundamental. It's not a bylaw to serve hamburgers on Tuesday or something, you know, insignificant. And I, you know, just in terms of the bylaws themselves, when they're ultimately revised, there would be a section of the bylaws that would state that, you know, bylaw X, Y, Z, you know, must be changed according, can only be changed according to the following provision. So it would be clearly set out in the bylaws, you know, that, you know, particular bylaws had different mechanisms and thresholds for change. So they're not. Other than that, they're not printed in red or set out with a star, but they are, you know, explicitly called out. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. Kavut, your hand is up.
Yes, I have no difficulty with that approach. The only thing how we distinguish, and you explained that we will distinguish by putting in particular section or so on and so forth. But now my question is that why for this title we have approved changes? We don't have reconsideration. We don't have rejection, we have only approved. It means that we don't send them for reconsideration or we have no power to reject them. We just, why we have different language and different term used here for this 654, approved changes. Why we don't have reconsideration and approve or reconsideration and reject? Why the title is different? Just a curiosity.
Yep. It's a fair question, Kavu. And the reason for that is about the nature of the process. The general bylaws changes, what we're asking for, the board proposes them after consultation with the community, and the power that is being proposed is to say, no, can't do it, sorry. With fundamental bylaw changes, the onus is reversed. A relatively high threshold of our approval is needed for them to happen. So we aren't actually asking for a reconsideration of this. We are saying that we achieve the same result by just not approving them. So the idea is that fundamental ones require more agreement, more assent. I personally am assuming that there will be a longer time period or even that the decision will need to be considered, for example, at two ICANN meetings. So the reason the title is different is to draw attention to the fact that it is a different process. It's a positive co-decision required in respect of approving fundamental bylaw changes. It isn't just sending them back to the board and saying no. That's the outcome. If we fail to approve the change to these fundamental ones, then we would have to have a vote to do it. Every single change that came up to a fundamental bylaw proposal would come to a vote. If a positive vote at the high threshold we set out wasn't given, then the bylaw change wouldn't happen. So that's why the language is different, because the nature of the power and the process is different. And that does segue us really nicely into 6.5.4, the power to approve changes to the fundamental bylaws. Aside from noting the comment that was already raised about which ones are fundamental and where they listed, signing which one, what else is here, people? What else would you like to raise and suggest and consider about 6.5.4, how to approve changes to the fundamental bylaws?
Jordan, I am not convinced. Who initiate the changes to the fundamental bylaws? ICANN board or community? Who initiate that? In the normal or traditional bylaw, the issue is here that ICANN start to change and the community has the right to reject or reconsider. But here, who initiate the changes to the fundamental bylaw?
In the first instance, to decide which ones are going to be fundamental, to create them in the first place, the answer is that the community will be proposing it through this CCWG process. So when we come to our final proposal, I'm very sure that we'll be saying, these are the bylaws that we recommend be made fundamental. This is the process for changing them that is set out. So I would imagine, I'm not a person who's okay with the bylaw change process in ICANN. So, Caboose, I would actually like to defer your question to someone who is. And I don't know whether Avery or Greg have got their hands up, are familiar with that. Can someone who could answer the question, so in other words, I assume that any SORAC can propose changes to the bylaws, and that wouldn't change, but the question is still an assent one. And the reason behind the assent logic here is that it's a higher threshold. It's harder to get everyone to vote in favor of the change, and also it avoids the problem of missing it. It avoids the problem of, oh no, we did have concerns, but we didn't challenge it in time, because the positive agreement would be required. So, Avery, you're next on the speaking list.
Yeah.
Caboose, we'll come back to you if the question isn't answered.
Okay. I was just going to give a quick answer to that. Avery speaking. Certainly ATRT, for example, and other review teams have suggested bylaws changes, so that's certainly some way that it happened in the past. And I do believe that an ACSO could suggest them. As I say, it's a mechanism that is a board mechanism, so it would be a recommendation made to the board to change a bylaw, and then there would be a board mechanism for doing it for review and for their decision making.
Thank you, Avery. Greg, you've got a hand up as well.
Thanks, Jordan. It's Greg Shatton. I don't have too much to add to what Avery says. I think that's right. And also the board can, on its own initiative, decide to amend a bylaw, which would, you know, then be a, you know, handled by a motion to amend a bylaw. I note that the board can only amend the bylaws, any of the bylaws, by a two-thirds vote at this point. I would assume, you know, the fundamental bylaws would probably require a higher threshold at the board level as well, as the approval of the members or designators or whatever it may be. So it would be harder at both levels to change a fundamental bylaw. You know, ICANN has interesting processes, you know, with various recommendations and reviews, you know, that will, you know, suggest or recommend bylaws, and there may be ways that a bylaw consideration, you know, could be forced. But I think, you know, here the issue is once we identify those fundamental bylaws and they are in place and deemed fundamental, you know, amending them would you know, could be proposed by an SO or an AC, but I think would then have to get traction on the board first. And it'd be a rather interesting issue if the change of a fundamental bylaw was desired by a supermajority of the community, but not by a supermajority or even majority of the board. I'm not sure if I'm imagining, you know, a worst-case scenario that might not exist. At that point, it's hard to imagine the board being that far removed from the community, given the number of board members that, you know, should be reflective of the community. But of course, sometimes the community, you know, looks at the board needs to look at the greater good for the longer term, and sometimes that's not where the community's head may be at. But typically, I don't think that's the case either.
Thanks, Greg. I think one of the things that it is a point. I've added another question in the next version of the document, the version I'll post after this, which is it's in that second sentence of this power, approved changes to some of the bylaws. It starts off, bylaws that are stated as fundamental. Now there's a comment that says, who can propose new fundamental bylaws or propose changes to existing ones? And then in brackets, the board can HRT reviews have done. And the CCJLEG is going to propose the semester processes leads to changes being considered. So it's getting this question on the table. Now, I've got a question, which is, are there any other... Oh, yeah, I see some hands. Greg, is yours the old hand here? Thank you. Caboose, go ahead.
Yes, I understand all that you said and Greg said, but my question, why we have different language here, approve changes instead of reconsideration and reject changes? That was my question.
Caboose,
I didn't have any other problem at all. I said, why different language is used? Thank you.
Because it's a different power, because we're not rejecting. Where this is a positive power for the community to be a full party to making the decision in favor of going ahead. And the decision to go ahead in changing these fundamental, special, entrenched, vital, protected bylaws, the whole argument that's been raised since this power was first discussed is that should be a very special one. And it isn't just up to the board to make that decision on their own. It's up to the board and the community together. The board is one version of the community elected by it. Whatever mechanism we propose or through SOAC processes to do the other side of that decision, to broaden out the set of people who are making it, to set a very high threshold for the approval of it. So the reason for the language difference is that it is an entirely different process. If the
disconnected.
You're
still there, Caboose. Stay on. Everybody stay on.
It isn't. Hi, everyone. I've tried to connect now using the Adobe Room. It seems like my telephone call connection has died. Are you able to hear me again?
Much clearer than it was before.
Yes, we hear you.
Yes, Jordan, it seems as if you've awakened from a sleep. Sounds great.
I have to say, I find the dialogue power really quite useless because it always drops at least once in a call. So if you were on voicemail, sorry, they're calling me again. Hello, Jordan speaking.
Hey, with Adobe, it's much clearer.
You hear me again? I've been redialed by the conference call type. Please let me know if you can hear me. I won't continue.
Yeah, we sort of hear you again.
Okay.
We hear you.
I was explaining why I thought it was important to have the status quo. I don't want to try and remember what I said. The question, Fabrice, it's just useful to understand if you understand that logic and disagree with it, or whether you don't understand. Otherwise, I'd like to move on to 6.5.5. Kabus may be having the same audio issues or not, but in the meantime, we will move on to 6.5.5. By the way, everyone, I would like to just thank you for the way that we're getting through this call. We're making quite a lot of progress. Robin, I see your hand up, and Olivier, I see your hand up. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Great. So on this 6.55 section, I had a couple of points. One has to do with the underlying text about the removal for the NOMCOM. It would be a removal by the community mechanism. And I think it was Avery proposed something like the IETF NOMCOM removal process. And so I thought that we're going to consider exploring that a little bit more as a possible removal process for a nominating committee board members. So that was one point. And then another point was the threshold that it's currently set at, and it says 40%. And I want to raise the same concern that I had before about that being considerably too low. I think that we want it to not be something that's going to be triggered every year, and so I think it should be a considerably higher threshold. And I'm also still very supportive of providing for flexibility within the different SOs and ACs about what level of support they want to require within their own stakeholder group to recall. So those were the only points that I had on 6.55. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. On the point about the IETF NOMCOM removal process, I'm not familiar with that, but I think Abri's in the speaking list, so might be able to just explain it briefly for us again. In respect of the threshold, at the end of the last call on this item, we did say that we'd say 40% while noting the range. If the view here is that we should just say that majority, so half plus one as a threshold, and just remove the reference to the debate, I'd be relaxed with that, personally. And I have noted the issue in the yellow text at the bottom of this item in respect of whether we should impose common requirements on SOs and ACs for their thresholds. There was talk of, like, setting floors and or ceilings for these and leaving some flexibility in that. There's a view that nothing should be decided. There's a view it should be totally prescribed. My view is that we should be able to have that discussion in the full CCWG, personally, unless there's a clear consensus here. How do people want to play that? I've got the comments there, rather than make a few responses. We'll move on, if we could, to Olivier.
I had the same comment that Robin about the NAMCOM appointees, but the problem is that I don't think it's very clear to understand that three lines in bold letters, the de-escalation mechanism. I just don't understand it. I don't know if it's the same for the other people.
Okay. So what it's trying to communicate is that we are not suggesting that the nominating committee would be the body that would decide to remove a director. So the normal process that we've agreed is that the directors that are appointed by SOs and ACs, it's their appointing body that would remove them. The suggestion has been that for nominating committee ones, it shouldn't be the nominating committee. So there would be a way to remove them through the community mechanism. I can see how the language isn't very clear about that and could definitely be improved. But is there, so aside from an undertaking to rewrite it so it's clearer, as I've just said, is there another point or a question arising?
No, I think it's more than a problem of language. I just don't understand what's the meaning of that mechanism. That's the only point, so thank you.
So did my explanation help to clarify it or not?
Not completely, I would say.
Let me try a different angle. If the question is, first of all, everyone seems clear that SOs and ACs should be able to remove their directors.
Yeah.
I don't think, in respect to power. So then the second question is, should it be possible to remove directors who are appointed by the NOMCOM?
Yes.
Yep. So my assumption there is yes, no one has said no. The third question then is, how should that be done? Should it be done by the NOMCOM or something else?
Yeah, I'm ready to hear any mechanism, but I don't understand the mechanism that describing the three lines here.
Oh, I see. So the problem is that we don't know what our mechanism is yet. We don't know whether it's the membership model or the designator model.
Okay, then it's fine.
That's what it's trying to connect to. Sorry. So
It's fine. Maybe we should add. Okay. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. That's a good point. Explain more clearly. Thanks.
Explain that it's...
mechanism referred to in 6.5.1 above, so we can just reference it straight back. Thank you. The next person with their hand up is Cubbers. Please go ahead.
Yes, on the previous question, my understanding is as yours. The removal of a director nominated by nominating committee would not be possible by nominating committee, would be by community. To a mechanism. What mechanism is, I don't know yet. So I have no problem. My problem is the threshold. I agree with Robin that the threshold is too low and you should higher it, you should increase it. And in the area that we are not sure, perhaps this is a practice used in other places, you put two values with obligate slope between the two, slash 50%, 67% to leave it to the selection, but 40% is too low, and the 80% and B%, we should have some ideas, because otherwise we have the same problem. I put the idea for the 8% would be 50%, and the idea of the B% would be 75% in a square bracket, just to give an idea. Otherwise, it could be any value. So my problem is the threshold. Thank you.
Okay, I would like to suggest as a way through this one that with the threshold to trigger, the sentence there says that it should be set at around 40% bracket arranged to 22.5 plus or most discussed close bracket. I'm going to suggest we delete that and just say should be set at a majority of those who would make the decision. That would essentially mean 50% plus one as a point for the discussion to flow with. Can I ask you to use your green voting buttons if you're happy to have that much higher threshold just be the only one that's mentioned, but noting it will be discussed on the full CCWG. Are people happy with that? Could you use a green agree button if you're happy with that as a kind of working hypothesis? Not to exclude it going higher later, but just to get that new text there. There's a few greens there. Okay, let's do that. So that you'll see that in the next draft. Sorry for the double micing just then. We'll carry on with our speaking list. Avery, you're next up.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, Avery speaking. I tend to, by the way, on that issue, tend to be into a higher threshold. I just wanted to quickly talk about the IETF model. It's defined in Best Current Practice 10 or RFC 7437. Basically, what they do is in the IETF thing, there's a petition. And if 20 people sign the petition, a special NOMCOM, a recall NOMCOM, is assembled. That NOMCOM reviews just one issue, and it's basically works on the same rules as a regular NOMCOM, and members are picked in the same way as a regular NOMCOM, which is very different than the way ICANN does it, but that's beside the point. That NOMCOM works on only one issue, is look at case for the recall of the particular, or it could even several, but the particular appointees, NOMCOM appointees in the IETF, they are all NOMCOM appointees, so it's the way they get rid of anyone. And they decide on a three-quarters basis to either remove them or not. So it is very much. Now, I understood from the lawyers, and I have a slightly different understanding than Kavush does, that if we're using either the member or some form of designator model, it is the member or designator that has to remove their board members unless there's some sort of complicated contract between the other members that says they can do it. But by and large, if you appoint them, you remove them. So the idea, if we were to follow that kind of model, it would require us writing a recall nomination procedure. And in fact, when you look at the IETF RFC, and I'll send you guys the URL to the RFC so you can all check it. You know, I'd say four-fifths of the document is about how the NOMCOM appoints, and then the sort section on how it recalls. And they use the term recall, not spill, not fire, but recall. So I can certainly send that, and if anybody wants, I can also volunteer to, you know, craft some sort of analogous possible process if people would want me to. Thanks. By the way, I spent 4 years as chair of the IETF NOMCOM, and I chaired the group that wrote one version of its procedures. So I've done way too much NOMCOM in my life.
Thank you, Avery, for that offer. I see no reason to not to ask you to do that if you're prepared to sort of write just one paragraph would be the length that we're after. And I've written a little comment bubble with some comments explaining this, so I would like to circulate that after this call. We've got about 5 minutes to go, so Kazuz, I'd ask if you've got a really quick point, and then I'm going to explain what will happen between now and our next call. Kuz, go ahead.
Yes. I think if I take the path described by Avery, the removal of individual board by the people, they nominating them, they designate them, SO and AC, is okay. But when it comes to the nominating committee, we need a threshold. So the threshold here maybe
say, from the removal of the board member nominated by nominating committee. So perhaps we need to rewrite this paragraph with respect to the removal of the board, individual board member. You could say that this removal will be done by the entity who have nominated them, who have designated them according to their internal procedures. Once to come to the nominating committee board member, then we should have a procedure because that is the community with you involved, and they should have a threshold. And that is, so we need to perhaps revisit this paragraph entirely, removal of the individual board member. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. I don't agree that we need to. And the reason, it's not that we don't have to do the work you've suggested, we do. But in this first public comment report, I think we're just trying to get some guidance from the community. The question will be, do you want the community mechanism to do this? Do you want the NOMCOM to do this? Do you want some other body to do this? Or do you want nobody to do this? So we do have to get out to the level of detail you suggest, but we don't have to do it now. So thank you for that. Ladies and gentlemen, we've reached the end of our call. Here's my proposal for our next steps. We've got another call in, God knows what is it, 19, 21, 22 hours, something like that. What I'm going to do straight after we finish is PDF my Word document with the comment bubbles that have come up already here in this conversation, and I'll email it around to you just to have a look at. When we start our next call, first of all, we will pick up where we've just gotten to, which is, if memory serves, just to the end of 6.5.5, and we will work through the rest of the comments. If I have time, I will circulate before the call, so at least 12 hours before it, a cut-down version of the document that has some recommendations about the remaining contentious issues. But I'm not promising that one. We might just have to do it on the call. So if you read this paper, this will be the sole subject of our next call because the point of it will be to come to agreement what we're going to propose through the CCWG. So that's it. That's all. Thank you very much for all of your work and contributions. This has been a good meeting as far as I'm concerned. And we'll talk to you again at our next call, which is, I believe, at 1900 hours on Thursday the 16th. Of April UTC. Have a great day, night, morning, evening, wherever you are.
Thanks.